Hello and welcome to the Dream Swarm podcast. This is your home for supernatural film, stories and art. I'm your host, magic realist filmmaker Andy Mark Simpson. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. Hello everyone and welcome to the next episode of Dream Swarm. I'm really pleased today to be joined by writer-director Aurora Fernley. So welcome Aurora.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. I'm really pleased you've come on. I've been watching your work for a while and I think that our Dream Swarm audience will be really interested in it. So could you just briefly introduce yourself and who you are and what you do?
So I'm a writer and a director. I'm originally from Stockport and then I spent about 10 years after that in Leeds. So I'm 30 years northern. Currently based in the South. I've made about 8 short films, a bit of TV, and I'm trying to get some features out there at the moment. And interestingly, I would say most of my short films don't necessarily all fit into the same category, but they all kind of explore the idea of otherness. And I think that comes into the supernatural quite a lot. So there are ties to lots of my projects that feel similar, but I didn't even realize it till I took a step back. So it's quite interesting after a 10-year career to go, oh, maybe I'm saying the same thing here.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to ask you about is what you think some of the themes are in your work, because I know not all of your films are supernatural and you've done dramas and things, but I've noticed similar themes. One thing I picked up on was kind of rules in place on women and who polices women and who polices women's behavior. So thinking of Struck, which wasn't one of your kind of supernatural or alternative history ones, that's got a lot about who's responsible for policing women's behavior and what women are allowed to do. But then thought there's similarities to Murmur as well, which is, would you say Murmur's kind of alternative history type film, and I thought that theme was similar and carried across there.
I think it's Rob Spranza who was in Sheffield to put my shorts on, and he was talking about it, and he said to me, all your characters are having conversations where they have different perceptions of reality, and like the conflict seems to be that one person has decided that they're seeing the world a certain way and somebody else has decided that actually that's not how they're perceiving it. And I guess that's what I'm really interested in, is the fact that two people can have the same experience or see the same event and come away with a totally different meaning. And so Struck, actually, weirdly, it's a two-person, one-shot film on a beach. And that was my attempt to address the Me Too crisis by saying, we can't take out the male point of view here on what it feels like for women to experience abuse. Because a man who can't help a woman has a feeling of losing his ability to be useful. And there were so many court cases where there was trauma for a man because the expectation was that he was to protect a woman. And that in the modern day, ask that question of what is a man? And what is it that we say when we say man up? And what do you do if someone that you care about goes through trauma? And does that create trauma that you're not allowed to actually inhabit because it's happened to a woman? So it was a really complex through line.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, like it deals with some big issues there, Struck. And you said that was all done in one shot as well. I noticed that it's all in one long take, and the kind of the actor blocking is a big thing about the style there and how the actors move around to change position through the shot. I mean, that's just me as a director. I tend to, you know, admire that kind of thing. I mentioned Murmur there. Could you tell us about your short film, Murmur?
Yeah, so Murmur is written by a Northern writer, Simon Cookson. And originally a piece of theatre that he'd been working on. And this is that strange landscape where you're not sure if you're in a certain time period, you're not entirely connected to where and when, but you're more connected to these two individuals in a crisis moment. It's really hard because everyone has their own personal view on what they think the film is about, what they're talking about. But again, there is this idea of, for one person, what feels like oppression to another is what feels like safety.
It's got those different points of views because, yeah, Murmur, like I say, they're in period costumes, but yeah, I didn't feel like it was a historical event that was being depicted. Like it feels like either an alternative history or is it even now when they're in a cult or something. And yeah, like you say, it's never really explained exactly what's going on. So it's the situation of two women coming to a fence and deciding, are they going to cross over and leave this area that they're in? But we're not given all the details, but it feels like a very rich world of things happening around them that we don't see in this 10-minute conversation. But it feels like a richness of the world around there.
Yes, yeah, so I guess that them getting to this fence and then, you know, this idea of crossing, it's the psychological barrier is hard to break than the physical barrier, and it's seeing what comes up for each one of them when they do try and take that kind of step beyond the world that for one of them has felt so trapping, and beyond that is freedom, and for somebody else it's only danger beyond that point of safety. and why they think that. And then even the further they get away from that place, what that means to them. And it's almost like memories start to change, or ideas start to change, or conversation allows a kind of expansion of their own personal awareness. But yeah, I mean, for 10 minutes, we did what we could.
No, I think it packs a lot in, but also, you know, leaves a lot to think about as well. And I think that's one of the marks of a really great short film, especially in the kind of world that I like exploring, is kind of supernatural or alternative realities and magic realism. You're presented with a certain reality, but then if there's other layers beyond that as well, and kind of other scope for a universe that inhabits, that, you know, you can't depict everything in a 10-minute short. So it's just about hinting at the world beyond that. I think it does really well at that. But talking about world building, just going to move on to your short film, Pulsar, which has an incredibly rich world painted in those, what's it, about 16 minutes, I think, Pulsar. So it's a sci-fi short film. Could you tell us about Pulsar?
Yeah, sure. So definitely some of my projects come from ideas around folklore. And Pulsar came from a competition called The Pitch, where you have to base your idea on a biblical character or story arc. You know, the Bible is there. It's one of the old folklores, isn't it? And so I took the character of Jonah in the belly of the whale, and I turned it into a kind of sci-fi space opera. And so I took everything that was sea and I made it space, but I also didn't want it to feel like it was too modern. So it has a very archaic feeling to it. Everything is worn and old and is more like a kind of seafaring world than it is a kind of modern sci-fi space world.
It feels like there's magic in there. It's not to do with like laser technology and things, which is in there, but the core of it, they use like old relics as stones and portents and things, don't they? So it does feel like there's something more ancient within that technological future.
The thing about Enter the Pitch is you don't have to be religious yourself in order to be able to apply for and win a fund. And when you've got £25,000 to £30,000 for a short film, that's a very good fund to go for, you know. So the story of Jonah is basically somebody who's asked to do something by their superior, and they reject it on a principle, which is pretty much racism. And as much as they try and get away from doing this task, everything sends them back to it, up to the point they allow themselves to be put into a situation where they will die. And it's only at that point that they're actually able to recognize that their fear of otherness, again, fear of somebody else, fear of another culture, fear of other people, has put them in this place where they would rather have lost their own life than to accept another group of people. And so that was really interesting, you know, having a death and rebirth scene, as it were. And then I finished the story not where the Bible story finishes, because the character doesn't really have a great arc. He does learn, he does go back, and he does repent. But in the biblical story, he gets pissed off again, he goes into the desert, and he just rails against God. Yeah. He just seemed like such a toddler. So I had to stop his story where I felt like he'd actually got to a place of growth.
Yeah, that makes it a good natural arc. Yeah, the Bible, as you say, it's full of great inspirations for stories. You know, Old Testament, I'd say, more than religious teaching. It's good inspiration for these stories. So yeah, so that Pitch Short Film Fund, that's a great achievement too, that you won the Pitch, because that's a lot of big competition, because it's a pretty decent budget for a short film. So there's a lot of people wanting to go for that. So for you to get through and be the winner of that fund, and to make, you know, you've then got to convert that into a good film, which you have done as well. So you really capitalized on that. You're talking about the kind of themes there in Pulsar. We were just chatting before about social realism and how we think there's a bit of a change now in trends towards magic realism or genre being explored a lot more with sci-fi and fantasy and horror films. Why do you think that might be?
That's a great question. Like, from my angle, I know why I've been going into those areas more and more. I started off doing dramas with a hint of supernatural right from the beginning, and stepped into genre in a big way when I realized that some of the things that I wanted to say as a writer and the things that really got me emotionally connected as a director, they could be explored in a more rich palette if I was to take them into a world of genre. So rather than it being a family situation with a particular topic that I could explore in the modern day, why not have a look at how that particular event might have unfolded in a future society where we've taken the ideas and the themes that I'm interested in and we push those out to the nth degree and see where they might go towards. Or like with the horror that I'm working on, let's put it in the past and let's have a discussion around how much has or hasn't changed for our society. Or would we treat people any differently in a different environment? Is this human nature? So I think you get to ask bigger questions, and it's, let's be honest, genre's really sexy. it looks great. You get to have a much more visual world to play with, and you can let your imagination go as much as you're tapping into archetypes.
So you're asking kind of bigger questions about the universe and our place within it and humankind's path through that, and how much has humanity really changed using past and future rather than just in the present. But also, yeah, as you say, like visually, and this is something I'm learning a bit as well, as I'm gravitating from being a social realist filmmaker to being more interested in genre and or blend of genres. It's just the visual palette that you then get of being able to find a cinematic way of expressing the interior of the characters and putting that visually exterior as well, which is really good as a filmmaker using visual arts. But just that collaboration with the other artists on set, with the production designers and the cinematographer, and then in the sound design as well, and being able to express those emotions and those characters visually as well. It just gives you so much more to play with, that whole toolkit to use.
I think what the world's got really weird in the last 4 or 5 years as well. And I think the only way to respond to that has been genre and humour. Like, we've all noticed that things have this thing. I don't know if it's we're actually in the pandemic at the moment, but before this, there was this change. Technology was increasing. We were seeing flare-ups of very similar social, political movements all throughout the globe. People were having very real concerns about climate change. We it felt like we were really moving collectively towards some kind of change as a species. There's something big on the horizon. I don't know if everyone else felt that, but the artistic work that came out as a result has been, it is a little bit safer right now to take something away from the modern, where we don't know where it's going to go, and to explore it in a place where it's a fantasy or where it's supernatural, where it has different power. We can explore the meaning of what we think is happening to us now or where we're going in a very different context. I think that's, for me, for the first time thinking about it, that's probably why we're getting this kind of dearth of genre, where we're digging down.
And also because I guess the present is never the present. It's always, you know, constantly changing, and we're living very turbulent times now, and it's hard to, and film takes so long to do. So it removes it from the very present to be general themes of the last couple of years without having to be right here and now. You know, by putting it in a fantasy world or in a sci-fi future world, you can talk about these changes, but almost with a bit of perspective on it as well, slightly removed from that, rather than the kind of hurly-burly of day-to-day immediate experience that a kind of social realist or documentary style might need. So what's next for you then? What else are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm writing a folk horror at the moment. I went to a folk horror conference. I keep wanting to say last year, but because now we're in 2021, the whole of 2020, no one went anywhere, did they? So it was the year before, in 2019, down in Cornwall, was a folk horror conference. And what I discovered is that it's kind of only really been canoned, I think, recently, the term folk horror, and in very much to do with like the British 1970s films. And then since that, you've had a lot of films that have been looked at that could fit that explanation of like a rural community with a ritual behavior where a stranger comes in from the outside. And that tends to be, you know, more modern films like Midsommar, even Hereditary, are going into that. So when I was there, what I discovered about folk horror is that there's not a single female director in the whole canon. And I was like, oh, right. But nearly so many of these stories are of female point of view, and we have the male gaze. And I find that really interesting. And I had an idea, and that's why I was there with the project, just researching changelings, which is quite similar to the Salem witch trial cases. There's lots of documentation of women and children who were accused of being fairies, or fae, they called them. And then they were actually killed and hung, and it was the village or a society or a court that would kind of go, yep, that's absolutely fine. We can see fairy possession. We're gonna get rid of this person for you, or we allow you to have murdered your wife for being a fairy, or for just strangling or drowning your child. And the bit that I was really fascinated about in the modern at the moment is how we are handling our connection to otherness with disability. And what I discovered was this idea of changeling children. They were nearly always different in some way that was so fearful to their society that they were killed. So that's something that, if I was to make a drama about it, like, you know, I don't know, an I, Daniel Blake in the modern day, I don't think people would respond very well and want to come to it. And they would probably say that I was being out of touch and that things aren't that bad and that we're not like that and we're a modern society. But you take that concept of harm towards people who are perceived still as other and put it in the past where we go, yeah, but they didn't know any better. And, you know, people back then, their behaviour was, you know, uneducated, fear-based, like the Crucible. And I go, yeah, sure, let's put it safely in the past where you don't have to connect it still to what happens in everyday here in the modern. And also I can make it into a folk tale for you where it feels like it can be something to be not even not to be learned from, but we can explore it safely and it doesn't have to be about you or me.
Yeah, people don't take it personally if they feel like it's removed from the day-to-day reality, but it's still, you're making a comment on, as you say, is that human nature now? Are people still making those judgments and uneducated judgments now as they were then and treating people as other and that fear of the other as well?
Well, we still have a discriminatory system and a government that we currently have does. I mean, I'm really tapped into what I see happening around and I go, wow, it's so interesting to see how we've not moved on in so many ways. But we've got a very nice veneer of social etiquette now that we can put down and say, no, no, things are being done. That's not how it is. We're good people. I think that's the big thing, is everybody wants to be good people. And if you take something that could spark a reaction of fear or otherness, it's like, oh, it would be completely justifiable for a village of people to want to kill a child who just seems other because they fear for that being a kind of like a virus, it would spread, or that it was a curse, or that. I think that's a really important factor in nearly everything to do with folklore, is that you do something, you get a response either from nature or from your environment. And we've lost that connection. We don't, you know, we're much more of an iPhone generation, and that idea of retribution or hexes or curses. I think there, again, it's also psychological. You do it to yourself. Something bad happens to you, you assume that you pissed somebody off and that she was a witch.
Yeah, I guess it looks at things to do with blame as well. There's a couple of things spring to mind. Of one, people getting defensive, you know, like you say, people want to be good people. They want to think that they are a good person and don't want to think that they're part of a thought system that is not being good at that moment. And there's things that I bought, and that'll be the same for disabilities as well, but things like Black Lives Matter, and you know, where they want to pretend that the situation is okay now. Oh yes, that was in the past, but it's fixed now. And when people are saying no, but it isn't fixed, they don't want to feel like they're part of that problem still, and they're kind of in denial about it. And that's my opinion on some of the psychology of that as well, is that it's like people want to believe their things are better and they're part of a good thing, and they're unwilling to kind of accept that there's still work to do towards being a good society. But also, yeah, thinking about blame is how in witch trials and things, it was these superstitious beliefs and how blame got put onto the vulnerable members of society who didn't seem to quite fit in properly into that. So that could be, as you say, vulnerable children and people with disabilities, or some difference that makes them stand out in some way from society. Women who were tried as being witches who were just maybe didn't fit into the standard norms of what the society expected, maybe were lived on the outside, on the edges a bit, they were blamed for anything else that would go wrong in society as well.
I think you're absolutely right, this idea of blame. The title of the folklore I'm working on is called Speak Its Name, and it actually came from a woman called Brené Brown, who talks a lot about the statistics of shame. And she said the only way that you can overcome shame is to speak its name. And I really like that idea, because the main character, her arc is, what will she do to herself and to her child through the shame that she's brought, or for the guilt that she feels? And I feel like with horror and with the supernatural, we can put, as you said, as we can project all of those things outside of us into monsters, into chaos, into the environment. But what's most terrifying is what people do to themselves inside their own heads, or what society, like a group of people, will decide has meaning and therefore allow themselves to do physically to each other. Yeah. So to me, that's horror.
Yeah, like you say, like a permission that they give themselves, especially in a group. And people have done experiments on this, where how far will people go once they feel part of a group that is doing something, and that kind of involvement in a bad group activity. I think there's things as well about, you know, whether people actually believe this thing or whether it's just a tool. Again, that society gets swept up in that, people actually, if they questioned it, even at the time, so you if you went to medieval times, did people actually believe that that woman was a witch who made a curse, or did they just not like her and were willing to go along with it in order to maintain a status quo? And you can't say exactly, but if you look again at human nature and things happening now, people might say things, but I don't think they actually mean it or believe it in a certain way. I think it's just an expedient way of getting others involved that, you know, they might not believe themselves, but it's a way of bringing people along. And you would never know at the time whether people actually believed in that or not, or was it just that they wanted to punish that or set the bounds of what's acceptable in society, and that is kind of their excuse for bringing people along.
What are you talking about is medieval trolling. Like the idea, I think Inside Number 9 did an episode where a woman was accused of being a witch in a big kind of courthouse trial in a kind of medieval setting, and the whole thing came out that pretty much that the children just wanted her house and wanted this woman gone. And I think there are so many cases of that, which is you troll somebody if you have the power to do it with something that's useful where you can take away their liberty. So yeah, it's the oldest form of trolling.
Yeah, you would never know like for sure without being able to get in their heads, but I do think there's that. And then you have Folk Horror, which your new film is, I think, from looking at a lot of folk horrors, even there you're not quite sure, even like in a standard kind of ones like The Wicker Man, if Lord Summerisle actually believes that this will cure the crops or if it's just a game to him or something else. So there's always that kind of ambiguity with it as well. But still the horror, still the punishment and the victimising and the othering of the innocent who's kind of come into that community.
Well, I guess the question is, how innocent are we? And I feel like all these films ask these questions. So you have somebody who goes in there and they go, I'm a good person, I'm from a good society and I've done good things. And they go to this environment where everyone has different rules and they have something to protect and they have a different way of behaving. And then that good person is challenged to reflect on everything that they've grown up with and why they believe that their rules and that their ideology is correct. And does that really make them good?
So again, like you were saying, for a lot of your work, you've discovered that it's about clashing perspectives and what one person thinks is the reality is in conflict with another person's view of reality. So yeah, but I guess there's folk horror where you're bringing two different societies together, or you're bringing, you know, one person from one society making them be outnumbered in another society. They're really forced to either vehemently defend what their point of view, or maybe start to question it and see how much they're going to kind of absorb the new environment that they're in.
Yeah, and I think folk as well kind of connects this idea of our fairy stories, and they were all made and told to us as a way for us to understand how society was going to be growing up. So those bedtime stories, those grim tales and all those fables that we've kind of been passed down and all the different cultures, it's our way of helping us mature our psychological understanding of you in circumstance, you and your parents, you and your society. And they're kind of the building blocks of an archetype for this is how we behave, and this is what happens if you don't, and this is what happens if you break rules. And so I think that's really interesting, because we're at a point now where our society is global. So we're having to look back. I think we are going back, and I said this at the start, we are digging, we're going back into archives and saying, what was it that we were telling each other in caves that made it work for us to work as a community or as an individual? And does that still work for us now?
Take a kind of anthropological look at stories and storytelling and their kind of functions in society. On Facebook, there's a folk horror revival, and there was a discussion on there the other day about whether there's a colonial view, and it's a world community now. And I guess the world, it's more connected now, but it was also connected in the 19th century. But that colonial thing where there's an imperial dominance that does kind of other different environments and portrays them as uneducated and uncivilized and savage and a source of fear and horror, mainly just because they're different in traditional places. And this question was, is folk horror exploiting that irrational fear of otherness and different cultures, or are there some folk horrors that highlight, you know, that dichotomy of people believing they're a good person, believing they're rational and intelligent, but actually they've forgotten the power of nature or the need to be a community? And so there are maybe some folk horrors and similar kind of supernatural tales that take that opposite viewpoint of praise and the more primitive elements in that rural environment and in the wilderness, but actually they're the bits that people need to appreciate more, rather than this kind of rationalized industrial viewpoint that's been trying to enforce itself on those people.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a big one, which is our connection to the natural world. So if you take a lot of British folk horror where there's paganism and there's worship of land And how much like places have meaning, they have belonging, they have trees have spirits, all these kind of things where we give respect to nature. And I think it's really good that we are, and again, potentially because it's safer to look at this colonial past that nobody's really taken responsibility for even today, and said, you know, you walk in there with self-righteousness, with being a good person, with power, and have to dismantle all of those ideas in order to be part of this society, or in order to understand this new world, which is your world, and how separate you are from it, and how much you've tried to dominate it or control it. The other film I'm working on at the moment is a sci-fi about climate change, and that is a big theme in that, which is how can we be so disconnected from our natural world? And again, it's not so much as saying it's science fiction as there's supernatural elements, which is, isn't nature amazing? And isn't it absolutely terrifying? Because no matter what we do, we cannot control it.
Yeah. So it's like the futility of it and the damage that it causes in trying to control nature and to run everything.
We're so egotistical. We really think that we can make, you know, oh, we can control the weather and we can do this and we can do that. And it's like, yeah, but the earth, it just needs to shrug and we'll all be gone. And the earth will be fine.
Yeah, there's definitely a power in nature that I think needs to be respected. And that's what I like about some of the folklore and kind of pagan beliefs is recognizing the power of nature, but also being grateful for it as well, I think, and not taking it for granted, you know, appreciating the natural world around us. And whether you just appreciate it because of the science of it and what you can see and rationalize about it, you know, you can appreciate it that way. But some people still do believe in nature spirits of the trees and things, which, you know, is all great. It's all kind of recognizing the beauty and the magic that we have in the natural world without trying to destroy it.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, it's cognitive, isn't it? We consider ourselves to be so clever because we've got the ability to think, and we've made tools and we've made patterns, and we've really capitalized on that as we've gone. And it's not so much that we're disconnected from nature, but I wonder if what we're exploring in this is, do we think we're better? Well, we do. We think we're better than most of the animals that we eat. We do think we're better than the land that we take. We think we're better than the turning things into plastic and not having respect for where it came from. I think we all feel it, which is, this can't go on exponentially. There has to be a repercussion, you know. And if it's not for the individual, is it for the group? And so, yeah, there is, in those small pockets where you have worship of a stream or a hill, or that there were magical people in this place, that small element of you in your environment being connected is terrifying, because we're so unconnected.
Yeah, there's a humility to that, isn't there? And an acceptance of not being as powerful as nature, but not wanting to be, you know, recognizing more of the value of folklore. It's all about, don't piss off the fairies. Like, just respect the environment around you. And that's another reason why I kind of like the folklore tales. It's that kind of attitude towards it, seeing the magic in nature.
There are rules. I think that's great. There's a whole set of different rules out there. And if you don't know them and you walk out there with your kind of arrogance and your colonial mindset and your power and, you know, your societal structure and your industrialization or your globalization, and you walk into a place where you don't know the rules, or you flagrantly go against the rules, you deserve everything that comes to you from the natural world. And in a way, do we enjoy watching these people get punished? Is this the guilt that we have? Are we enjoying being punished a little bit here? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess, again, displacement and blame, as you can in genre as well, especially horror, it's there as entertainment, and you are entertained by that pompous person taking all their rational control of the universe and going against the force of nature or a force of supernatural power that they can't control, and maybe you kind of have a bit of delight in them being punished. But again, it's that step of removal, isn't it? You can delight in that character being punished, but then it's only when you question it deeper that you see that maybe you're part of a society that is trying to enforce that view, that is, do we deserve to be punished as well? And that kind of shifting the blame around and removing it one step allows you to be entertained, but it's only when you think more deeply that you think, actually, maybe that's a lesson for us as well.
Yeah, and the good thing is with these is we're not we're not doing lessons necessarily that anyone needs to take away. It's just a discussion point because we don't have the answers either, but we definitely love getting involved in it. I don't know what our civilization is going to be like in 10, 20, 50 years. And I wouldn't want to project where we're going, but I definitely think by looking at how we respond to our environment and how we have done in the past, and also how we're responding to ideas of what is a folklore, what is a fairy tale, will we ever really change that much? I mean, the robot thing and the AI thing is I'm sure going to be exponentially looked at, but I would like to see that looked at from the same point of view. Let's have a discussion about algorithms where we don't take it away and make it into consciousness. Let's talk about what algorithms are in terms of the fact that they exist in plant life already. So let's stop making it into robotics and let's think about it as something natural. I don't know.
I've really enjoyed this interview, and we've got into loads of big questions to say, question society, and talking about how your work has these big questions, but you've got these different forms of films. You've done films that deal with kind of alternative histories and folklore and sci-fi and folk horror. We've been able to tie these big questions up through those different genres. It's been really good chat. Before we end then, how can people follow your work or follow you? What's the best way to keep tabs on what you're up to?
I've tried to be really consistent throughout all of social media, so it's just my name, Aurora Fernley, at Twitter or Instagram or whatever, Facebook, so you can find me and follow me doing things. I won't have any answers for you, but I'm happy to join a debate on the question.
So for everyone, if you want to keep in touch with Aurora's work, I've got some links on the Dream Swarm website, watch like Pulsar, and there's a link to that. Follow Aurora on at Aurora Fernley on Instagram, Twitter, etc. You can see what Aurora's up to next and keep an eye on her work. Well, thanks very much for this. I've really enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, me too. Really great discussion. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dream Swarm podcast. I've been your host, Andy Mark Simpson. We hope you'll join us for the next one. Remember, you can subscribe to stay in touch with future episodes and follow us at the website www.dreamswarm.org or follow on Twitter and Instagram at Dreamswarm. And we look forward to joining you for more supernatural film stories and art. In the meantime, be creative, be curious, be kind. We'll see you soon.